Thank you very much. Thank you to Sebastian for organising this wonderful event and for inviting me and everyone else to come and talk about this subject, these subjects. This is a paper of two halves, the first part being broadly pessimistic about the subject of environmental visualisation, and the second half broadly optimistic, or an attempt at optimism. My interest in the subject stems from long-standing research interest in the history of science, but also in the history of design and visualization itself. As an illustration of this, the image on the opening slide is a trade balance time series chart taken from William Playfair's Commercial and Political Atlas of 1786, widely regarded as the first publication to feature statistical display, statistical graphics. Playfair, a Scottish-born political economist and engineer, is credited with inventing the line graph, the pie chart, the bar chart, the circle graph. His work single-handedly established modern data visualization. Yet it's curious to note, at the same time, that he did not invent the scatter graph, which is to say, he never appeared to grapple with our peculiarly contemporary problem of representing uncertainty. This is something to which I will return briefly at the end of the paper, although I should say the paper is not entirely about uncertainty at all. So part one, pessimistic. We were talking at lunch about pessimism and optimism, and it suggested that we may have parked past peak pessimism now. I hope so. The title of this paper, of Exactitude in Science, is borrowed from a celebrated one-paragraph short story by the Argentinian writer Jorge Luis Borges, of Exactitude in Science, Del Rigor en la Ciencia in Spanish, which was first published in 1946. It's a story that speaks directly to this paper's interests, so it's worth reading in full. It's only a paragraph. In that empire, the art of cartography attained such perfection that the map of a single province occupied the entirety of a city, and the map of the empire, the entirety of a province. In time, those unconscionable maps no longer satisfied, and that's the cartographers' guilds struck a map of the empire whose size was that of the empire, which coincided point for point with it. The following generations, who are not so fond of the study of cartography as their forebears had been, saw that that vast map was useless, and not without some pitilessness, they delivered it up to the inclemencies of sun and winter. In the deserts of the West, still today, there are tattered ruins of that map, inhabited by animals and beggars. In all the land, there is no other relic of the discipline of geography. The story elaborates on an idea introduced by Lewis Carroll's philosophical novel, Sylvie and Bruno Concluded, of 1893. I'll read a section from that too. And then came the grandest idea of all. We actually made a map of the country on the scale of 1 mile to 1 mile. Have you used it much? I asked. It's never been spread out yet, said Mein Herr. The farmers objected. They said it would cover the whole country and shut out the sunlight. So we now use the country itself as its own map. And I assure you, it does nearly as well. That nearly is brilliant. Carroll and Borges's one-to-one scale maps offer a Baroque response to what is known among mathematicians and philosophers as the map-territory relation, which states essentially that the map is not the territory. Draping the lived world in a two-dimensional printout of itself also offers a powerful image of data overload, of smothering ourselves, literally, in so much data, in so much map, that we cannot see the territory. We lose sight of the thing itself. In some respects, I would argue, the problems that arise from visual representations of any kind of data are all variations on the map-territory relation, the map-territory problem. The crux of the problem is, of course, that we inhabit a three-dimensional world, but we are fated to represent it only in two dimensions. Whether on paper or on screens, information inhabits flat land. And many of the challenges we encounter in visualization flow from that inescapable fact. The world is 3D, information is 2D. A good illustration of this is probably the best known scene from An Inconvenient Truth. It's been mentioned before. I think it'll probably be mentioned again in this conference. 2006 movie. Probably the best known scene when Al Gore is hoisted by a hydraulic lift some 10 meters up the y-axis of an elongated graph that plots likely atmospheric concentrations of carbon dioxide projected to the year 2100. After 2050, I'm going to swap to this microphone. Is that okay? After 2050, when the... I feel like... after 2050, when the projected concentrations of CO2 are predicted to go up to 550.
There is a pointer, if you want.
Okay. I like using my hand, actually. This is my pointer. after the 2100, where the concentrations of CO2 increases to 550 parts per million by volume, the temperature, you know, the concentration line goes soaring beyond the furthest extent of the fireman's lift, in a dramatic literalization of the statistical concept of a measurement going off the scale. "You've heard of off the charts," asks the elevated Gore, to a ripple of nervous laughter from the audience. It's a memorable visual conceit, bringing home the scale of our increasing CO2 emissions. But it also serves to highlight, rather pathetically, the inescapable two-dimensionality of the graph. Gore has no option but to ascend this flat surface, to enact in two dimensions the movement of the y-axis, blending into his own PowerPoint slide. An example of the dangers of the map becoming the territory. He has to negotiate the graph physically as though it was the thing itself, as though this map was the territory. This essential flatness of scientific data is something that the French sociologist Bruno Latour has explored and critiqued, observing that we start seeing once we stop looking at nature and look exclusively and obsessively at prints and flat inscriptions. Commenting on his sociological study of a biology laboratory in 1990, Latour notes how he was struck by the transformation of rats and chemicals into paper. He grew, he says, less interested in the literature, that is, in the papers being produced, and more interested in what the laboratory itself was made of. Is a quote from Bruno Latour. Instruments, for instance, were of various types, ages and degrees of sophistication. Some were pieces of furniture, others filled large rooms, employed many technicians, and took many weeks to run. But their end result, no matter the field, was always a small window through which one could read a very few signs from a rather poor repertoire. Diagrams, blots, bands, columns. All these inscriptions could be integrated as figures in the text of articles that people were writing. That's the end quote. In other words, the instruments and the materials at which those instruments were pointed inhabit a colorful, three-dimensional, sensory world, but the end products of the research are always flat, monochrome slabs of data, whether in the form of charts or diagrams, none of which, of course, as Latour says, are neutral. The charts and diagrams that Latour's scientists are busy producing are replete with methodological and political bias. I mean, I'm sure Martin will be, and others will be talking about these in more detail. The data, evidence, having to be manipulated visually in order to be visualized, graphically tweaked in order to support whatever underlying argument is being promoted. The problem is exemplified by the well-known, perhaps too well-known, hockey stick controversy from the late 1990s. I've got a slide of the original hockey stick. Is this one of the many images you never want to see again? Michael Mann et al.'s hockey stick curve was designed to show reconstructed estimates of Northern Hemisphere mean temperature changes over the past 1,000 years. The term hockey stick was not Michael Mann's own. He called it the MBH-98 reconstruction, the initials of the team that put it together. But the hockey stick name was widely adopted during the dispute that followed the graph's appearance as a key piece of evidence in the third assessment report of the IPCC, published in 2001. The dispute centered on technical aspects of the methodology and the data sets used in creating the reconstruction, particularly the reliance on non-instrumental proxy data, such as tree rings, ice core samples, and isotopic analyses of coral. But though it's visually striking, looked at from an information design perspective, the graph is not all that easy to follow. For a start, it does not show actual temperature rises over time, but departures from the 1961 to 1990 average, as represented by the horizontal bar at degree zero, which in some ways is a confusing choice of start temperature, to start at zero. And visually, there's a lot going on, particularly with the light gray shading in the background, which indicates uncertainty ranges, literally the gray area, which, as can be seen, are unusually wide, though not surprising if one considers that what the graph shows are estimated variance from an estimated average over a long period of time. The chart attracted criticism for the way that it appeared to emphasize the flatness of the 900-year average line, the so-called hockey stick, the shaft of the stick, which then J-curves abruptly from the turn of the 20th century to form the dramatically rising blade. Suggestions were made that Mann and his team selected or even modified their proxy data in order to create a smoother historical lead-up, thereby giving a misleading visual impression that recent rates of warming are unprecedented. After all, the gray shading of the uncertainty area, the uncertainty ranges, show similar temperature anomalies to those that appear in the more recent instrumental data, which is colored red. Excuse me. Mann's critics, such as the German climate scientist Hans von Storch, who is far from skeptical about the reality of anthropogenic warming, have pointed out that the graph contains a range of assumptions that are not statistically permissible, even though they agree that the data does show an overall temperature rise occurring over recent decades. These and other objections prompted a lengthy correspondence between Mann and his critics, which culminated in a Congress-appointed National Research Council report published in 2006, which concluded that any statistical shortcomings in the analysis were too minor to have influenced the overall findings. So it's worth reiterating that the NCR found in favor of the hockey stick's credibility, as it's often claimed incorrectly that the graph has been discredited as junk science. I've got a slide from a wonderful recent book by David McCandless called Information is Beautiful, showing the original graph and the composite of later modifications to it. you might recognize some of these other images, including the image on the bottom of the top half of the slide, which was the one that Al Gore ascended in the famous moment from Inconvenient Truth. Now, it's interesting that the hockey stick controversy, which served as a noisy political distraction from the underlying issue of responding to anthropogenic warming, did not focus solely on the disputed objectivity or otherwise of the data, but also on the design of the graph itself. The original hockey stick, viewed as a purely visual artifact, made a powerful rhetorical statement, but there was something methodologically clumsy about the way that the flatness of the 900-year lead-in was insisted upon visually, as though our understanding of climate change is dependent upon the particular shape of a drawn curve. As von Storch aptly commented, the dispute in the end was all about, quote, the wobbliness of the shaft, which is to say it was all about the way the flat data was visually displayed. Okay, part two, optimistic. One of the challenges of climate change is that we cannot see it happening. We can see some of its effects, but not its causes. Increases in atmospheric greenhouse gases occur invisibly. And though, of course, they can be detected and measured, the fact of their invisibility remains a consistent barrier to action. If the sky somehow changed color as a result of increased greenhouse loading, we wouldn't have a problem now. Emissions would have been entirely halted decades ago. But since the sky looks more or less the same, no matter what we pump into it, what is needed is some kind of convincing visual representation of invisible atmospheric change, such as the brilliantly colored graphics that showed the ever-widening hole in the ozone layer above Antarctica. First published in 1985 by NASA's Scientific Visualization Studio at the Goddard Space Flight Center, these false color graphics succeeded in visualizing an otherwise invisible process, and in such a striking and memorable manner that they served to alert the world to a looming environmental threat. The entire process was remarkably quick. In the 1970s, researchers at the British Antarctic Survey had discovered that ozone concentrations above Antarctica appeared to be depleting. And as a consequence, the level of ultraviolet radiation reaching the poles was steadily increasing. The culprit was soon discovered and soon identified in the form of chlorofluorocarbons, CFCs, man-made compounds invented by industrial chemists in the late 1920s and put to use in an array of applications including refrigerators, air conditioners, solvents, and propellants. By 1985, worldwide production of CFCs stood at around 2 billion tons per year. But the problem with these compounds is that once they've been evaporated into the stratosphere, they are broken down by UV radiation and their chlorine atoms released. Since chlorine can remain aloft for many decades, during which time a single atom can catalytically convert up to 100,000 ozone molecules into oxygen, even over the Earth's mid-latitudes, it soon became apparent that the ozone hole over Antarctica was only the opening rend in our planet's UV-protecting veil. The wake-up call was a paper written by researchers at the British Antarctic Survey, published in Nature in May 1985, in which the severity of the problem was demonstrated beyond doubt. NASA's false color visualizations soon began to appear, and appear very widely. And it was this combination of instrumental evidence and compelling graphic imagery that galvanized the world into immediate action. The United States took the lead by banning the use of CFCs in spray cans And a couple of years later, the United Nations Environment Programme proposed the creation of a global convention guaranteeing the protection of the ozone layer. In 1987, this UN convention led to the signing of the Montreal Protocol, a treaty that deserves to be more famous than it already is, because it represents humanity's first major victory over a global environmental crisis. Compared with the quagmire into which the Kyoto Protocol negotiations sank, the Montreal Agreement was a model of effective and rapid international action, with every developed nation in the world willingly committing itself to the total elimination of CFCs from all industrial processes by 1996. Nearly two decades on from that first Montreal deadline, and the ozone hole is already beginning to heal. Last month, the UN revealed that the ozone layer is recovering so well, it will have effectively repaired itself by the middle of our present century. And there is, moreover, a welcome side effect. The Montreal Protocol has also contributed to limiting atmospheric warming, which was not its purpose, since some of the chemicals banned under the treaty are also powerful greenhouse gases. Now, the healing of the ozone layer offers a corrective to environmental pessimism over climate change. Although the problem with fossil fuels is that, unlike CFCs, they are not easily isolatable from their many uses. We use fossil fuels in just about every aspect of our lives. But even so, the Montreal Protocol offers hope for the speed and effectiveness of political change once a decision has been made. In the case of the Montreal Protocol, the catalyst was a spectacularly successful visualization. It should serve to remind us also that swift action can still prevent further catastrophe. And it really was swift. Between the visualization of the ozone hole and the signing of the Montreal Protocol was a mere 2 years. It should also remind us of the power of that visualization, like the blue marble that we've seen, like Earthrise. The ozone graphic was an environmental image that changed humanity's perception of the world. Now, the effectiveness of the ozone imagery of the mid-80s has not been repeated in the context of climate change. Ice caps and polar bears are just eco-wallpaper. There have been some striking data visualizations nonetheless. We've already looked at the hockey stick graph and the arguments over its somewhat misleading shape. The earlier Keeling curve, even better known perhaps, is a better example of a strong, simple visualization that does what the statistical theorist and designer Edward Tufte has described as visualization's main purpose: to, above all else, show the data. In this respect, the Keeling curve is one of the most successful and influential graphs ever made. In fact, ever since Charles David Keeling of Scripps University Institute of Oceanography began to collect atmospheric carbon dioxide data at the Mauna Loa Observatory during the International Geophysical Year of 1958, the story of global climate change has been narrated through a series of upward trending graphs, Keeling's being the first and easily the best known of them, not least because of its starring role in Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth. It's that man again. The visual effectiveness and explanatory power of Keeling's design is due to its uncluttered simplicity. It shows the data and nothing else. Unlike the hockey stick, there's no room for ambiguity. The curve's content is easily readable as a year-on-year increase in CO2 concentrations from around 315 parts per million by volume in 1958 to its current levels of just over 390. And then there is its distinctive shape, the fearsomeness of the almost steadily rising red line being much enhanced visually by its saw-toothed jaggedness. Yes. The regular up and down variations caused by the annual greening and wintering of the Northern Hemisphere, a seasonal leafy uptake of CO2 that serves to reduce the ever-increasing atmospheric load by about 5 parts per million by volume every year. The jagged Keeling curve is probably the most important data set in environmental science, and it's become a freestanding scientific icon in its own right, as can be seen on this slide. It's a collection of uses of it, including this screen grab from An Inconvenient Truth, where you had this screen was filled with a decontextualized close-up of the sawtooth, with Al Gore saying in the background, you know, with a sort of drumbeat in the background. And interestingly, the way that it is often used against a backdrop of whole Earth imagery, as though this is how we, you know, a way of visualizing an otherwise invisible process is occurring across the entirety of the atmosphere. It's used very powerfully, I think. a potent visual synecdoche for the inexorability of human-enhanced climate change. The way that the line is often shown against a planetary background is an attempt to visually relate the data to its context. Now, of course, the Keeling curve is dealing with a single source data set, while the hockey stick invoked a range of proxy and estimated data sources. But it is surely the way that the Keeling curve shows the data, in Edward Tufte's phrase, that gives it such a commanding voice and presence. I want to turn to Edward Tufte for the last few minutes of this paper, as he's someone with a lot of valuable things to say about visualization and its discontents. In December 2010, Tufte made the surprising decision to sell off his research library at Christie's Auction House in New York. The sale catalog, Beautiful Evidence, the library of Edward Tufte, is an extraordinary artifact in itself. And it's filled with insights and reflections on the evolution of Tufte's thinking on the visual display of quantitative information over many decades. It's the image reproduced on the catalog's back cover from William Playfair's Commercial and Political Atlas being a case in point. This is the graphic that I started with, and that Tufte identifies as having laid the foundation of modern statistical display. Playfair, wrote Tufte, eliminated much of the non-data detail in favor of cleaner designs that focused attention on the time series itself. The image, and Tufte uses this image to illustrate his own maxim of the fundamental principle of good statistical graphics: above all else, show the data. That should have been my title, I think. Above all else, show the data. It's a quote from Tufte. This principle is the basis for a theory of data graphics. As an invention, Playfair's graphs were masterpieces of rhetorical simplicity and clarity. They really did show the data. As the American statistician Howard Wehner notes in his recent study, Picturing the Uncertain World, for imports and exports over time, line graphs were the logical design of choice, while other kinds of information led to other kinds of graphical display, such as bar charts and pie charts. They were all very clear and precise, with no uncertainty expressed. But then Playfair was not, in the main, dealing with the kind of information that came laden with uncertainty, rather like Keeling's curve, which owes a lot to the visual clarity and the ethos of visual clarity established by Playfair 2 centuries before. Now, this, of course, this is not where we are now. But though climate science has never been an exact science, I would argue that Tufte's maxim, above all else, show the data, remains particularly significant in the context of atmospheric observations, which are instrumentally detectable but otherwise invisible. The problem with climate change is that the only thing that can be seen is the data. And so it's the way in which that data is made visible that determines how we understand and indeed how we act on what is happening to our atmosphere. If I have time, I want to end with an example of a visualization that I think succeeds and fails in equal measure, and that illustrates the kind of challenge that we face. When Silke showed her chocolate wrapper, it reminded me of this, which I photographed from the back of a 2-pint carton of British supermarket milk. The carbon footprint being a visual literalization of a complex spatial metaphor that translates notional volumes of emitted carbon dioxide and other invisible greenhouse gases into an annotated visual icon. As a visual statement aimed at consumers, it's both clear and unclear at the same time, not helped in this instance by the quaint British mix of imperial and metric units, as well as the conflation of volume and weight measurements. We've got pints and grams mixed up together. It shows the data, but it doesn't show what we're meant to do with it. It's why I remain both optimistic and pessimistic about the effectiveness of environmental visualization. As Sebastian said in his introduction, some images are weak, while others have a strong explanatory force. I think this is a very good illustration of that. I wanted to end with a quotation from Paul Valery, which I came across after I'd sent this paper off. I don't know what it is in French, but in English it is, and I think this is a great maxim to bear in mind, everything simple is false. Everything that is complex is unusable. Thank you very much.